Hello everyone, welcome to On the Regular. If our relentless drive for clarity strips away the necessary ambiguity of human work, are we creating systems that look perfect on paper, but inevitably break when the unexpected finally arrives? The screen glowed with a grid of 63 columns and 254 rows, a tiny canvas that defined the future of business. It was December 1979, and the Apple Robot II hummed quietly in a dark room, its memory limited to a fraction of what we take for granted today. Yet in that box of constraints, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston had built a machine that could recalculate the world in seconds. They stored cells in fixed 32-byte chunks to save memory, forcing every design decision into a calculation about overhead. This tiny grid became the first killer app, compelling people to buy hardware specifically to run it. It turned the Apple Robot II from a hobbyist toy into a weapon of financial warfare. The numbers on the screen did not just reflect value, they created it, allowing executives to prune and invest without waiting weeks for the math. But as the grid filled, something else began to happen. The variables that did not fit the cells were simply ignored. The optimization was clean, but the reality was messy, and the cost of that legibility was a fragility that would only become clear decades later. The story begins with the hardware constraints of the late 70s. Software Arts engineered VisiCalc Calc around the severe limitations of the Apple Robot II, which possessed hundreds of thousands of times less memory than a modern laptop. The team wrote the entire package in assembly code for the 6502 microprocessor. Every design decision became a calculation about how to save on memory, with cells stored in fixed 32-byte chunks to minimize overhead. Despite these physical limitations, the software allowed users to calculate and recalculate things instantly, executing complex formulas programmatically instead of by hand. What had once taken hours now took minutes, transforming the Apple Robot II from a hobbyist device into a useful business machine. Journalist John Markoff described it as being sold mainly as a VisiCalc accessory. It became the first piece of software so compelling that people bought hardware specifically to run it, establishing the first of the killer apps that would define the industry. Before this interactive electronic interface, the brain of the firm relied on the labor-intensive apparatus of the control revolution. At a company like General Motors, hundreds of reports from operations would flood into headquarters every week, requiring clerks to transcribe figures onto columnar pads. These were long sheets of green-tinted paper, ruled into columns and rows, where aggregated numbers were fed to supervisors who summarized them further for managers. This process involved armies of clerks and punchcard processors to coordinate action at scale, creating a bureaucratic entity designed to manage labor and capital. Managers would compare this month's figures with last month's figures, identify variants, propose explanations, and compose typewritten memos about their findings before transmitting decisions back down the hierarchy. The electronic spreadsheet replaced this manual hierarchy with a fusion of the organizational metaphor of the columnar pad and the interactivity of word processing. You could now calculate and recalculate things instantly, and things that would have once taken you hours now took you a few minutes. This shift meant that interacting with the spreadsheet felt like working with a physical document, allowing managers to see how they might grow by pruning here and investing there without waiting weeks for manual labor to complete the math. The era of technologies designed to communicate information and coordinate action at scale included the telegraph, the rotary power printer, the filing cabinet, the typewriter, the telephone, the punch card processor, and the columnar pad. You might have heard this term from economist Thorstein Veblen, who used it to describe how big companies in the early 1900s hired armies of clerks to manage information at scale. Think of it as the era before computers, when punch cards and columnar pads coordinated everything from payroll to production. This manual system is exactly what the electronic spreadsheet would later replace, turning hours of calculation into seconds. That's the context for what follows. This transition fundamentally altered the cultural landscape of the corporation. The cultural impact of this shift was recognized as early as 1984, when Harper's Magazine ran an article announcing the emergence of a spreadsheet way of knowledge. The publication noted that a virtual cult of the spreadsheet had formed, complete with gurus and initiates, detailed lore, and arcane rituals. There was an unshakable belief that the way the world works can be embodied in rows and columns of numbers and formulas, similar to how double-entry bookkeeping gave merchants a more accurate picture of their businesses during the Renaissance. The article compared the electronic spreadsheet to double-entry as an oil painting is to a sketch, suggesting a qualitative transformation in the work being done. Like the new spreadsheet, the double-entry ledger, with its separation of debits and credits, gave merchants a more accurate picture of their businesses and let them see how they might grow by pruning here, investing there. This new tool allowed for a dramatic speed-up in calculation, but it also represented a qualitative transformation in how value was perceived and created within the American corporation. The quantitative improvement was so dramatic that it reshaped the organization from a managed entity into an optimized financial asset, prioritizing speed over the nuance of human context. Yet this optimization introduced a fragility where complexity was hidden behind a clean interface. The 63-column 254-row limitation was not just a technical constraint but a philosophical one, forcing users to ignore variables that did not fit the model. As Software Arts floundered and was sold to Lotus in 1985, the market leader changed, but the underlying logic remained fixed. The efficiency gain did not account for the unquantifiable relationships that held the organization together. The true power of this logic was revealed in the high-stakes world of finance. Michael Milken's X-shaped trading desk in Beverly Hills was lined with personal computers running spreadsheets that tracked the high-yield bond markets he mastered. This technology allowed Colbert Kravis Roberts to execute the 1979 acquisition of Howdale, a manufacturer of auto parts, by putting down only $1 million of its own capital to acquire the company for $355. The leveraged buyout relied on the immense calculation power of Visi Calc on the Apple II, enabling executives to model a huge range of scenarios where small tweaks to assumptions had enormous effects on equity returns. Because leverage magnifies gains just as it magnifies losses, the deal created a magnificent asymmetry of risk and reward where losses fell largely on lenders. It was Milken who financed a massive share of the decade's LBOs through his mastery of the high-yield bond market, and he kept track of it all through the spreadsheet. This was the leveraged buyout, the LBO, which had been pioneered by a small firm called Colbert Kravis Roberts to demonstrate how lucrative the technique could be. The once sleepy field of mergers and acquisitions became a national obsession inspired by KKR's success, and countless buccaneering types rushed in to make enormous fortunes buying legacy firms. However, the dry logic of the spreadsheet offered a very effective way of winning the argument against those who understood the unquantifiable nature of corporate health. The financial ideology saw the corporation as a bundle of assets and cash flows to be optimized rather than an organization to be governed. Consequently, Howdale was dissolved in 1987, with the debts from the LBO largely responsible for killing the company. Whether this was good for the companies bought by private equity is another story, but LBOs killed a large share of the companies they touched. The challenging part of the LBO was that it required an immense amount of calculation, and before the spreadsheet, analyzing a single company would take weeks. Once VisiCalc was released, you could build an LBO model on your desktop and watch the entire structure of the deal recalculate itself before your eyes. What had once taken weeks or days now took hours or minutes, meaning the Howdale playbook could now be attempted at much greater scale. This hollowing out was not an anomaly, but a systematic consequence of the spreadsheet revolution felt in every corner of corporate America. From the 1980s onwards, countless American corporations were reshaped according to the dictates of the spreadsheet, including Boeing, General Motors, and General Electric. We see in every one of these cases the elevation of the finance guys and the preference for share buybacks and special dividends over capital investment. It was natural, according to the logic of the spreadsheet, for a company like Boeing to outsource the design and manufacture of critical components to suppliers around the globe. Yet the spreadsheet could not capture the accumulated systems integration knowledge that Boeing's engineers possessed, or the institutional capacity to coordinate immensely complex manufacturing processes. This led to the steady atrophying of engineering and manufacturing capabilities amid endless financial optimization, including the hollowing out of scientific R&D budgets. General Electric similarly prioritized quarterly earnings targets, while the spreadsheet concealed as much as it revealed about what made the best companies thrive. The very best companies behave more like cults or armies than like bundles of assets, and you cannot encode that understanding in a spreadsheet. But with the spreadsheet, it is very easy to represent a company as a purely financial entity, making calculations so cheap that you could work iteratively until you got the answer you wanted. This shift towards legibility prioritized quantifiable optimization over unquantifiable human context, setting the stage for the next wave of digital automation. If the spreadsheet turned companies into bundles of cash flows, the emerging AI ideology will see the corporation as something like a vast network of legible workflows. Microsoft Excel's Goal Seek and Solver functions, both present by the early 1990s, made this logic explicit. Each previous ideology of the corporation illuminated something real about its character and potential, but each also, in the fullness of time, deformed it. The financial ideology was blind to what could not be quantified, and the AI ideology, I suspect, will be blind to what cannot be made legible as a workflow. To understand this deformation, we might look to fiction for a warning. Terry Pratchett believed you should start with Sorcery, not just because it is early in the in-world chronology of one of the main sequences, but because it forcefully establishes what is perhaps the central dogma of Discworld, that people who think they are special and chosen are dangerous and bad for the world. The story revolves around Discworld's satirical version of the Chosen One plot arc, where sorcerers, wizards who are sources of magic and thus immensely more powerful than normal wizards, were the main cause of the great mage wars that left areas of the disc uninhabitable. As 8 is a powerful magical number on Discworld, men born as the 8th son of an 8th son are commonly wizards, and since sorcerers are born the 8th son of an 8th son of an 8th son, they are wizards squared. To prevent the creation of sorcerers, wizards are not allowed to marry or have children, but in the novel, the prevention mechanisms fail, and a sorcerer is born to wreak havoc. A sorcerer tries to do dumb Chosen One things until one of the main protagonists of the world, Rincewind, a hapless, mediocre wizard, manages to contain him. The mediocre protagonists of Discworld rarely act alone and never in hero mode, proving that most Discworld stories are, to a first approximation, carrier bag stories, a term linked to the carrier theory of fiction by Terra Ignota, where antagonists are usually just contained and neutralized, and sometimes even redeemed, rather than vengefully made an example of by protagonists. The auditors of reality are particularly interesting as the personification of deadening bureaucratic perfectionism, serving as the despoiled edition of what I've called the great bureaucrat archetype elsewhere. Their ideology is something like the wokeism of despoiled, a deadening, stifling, faceless force of intersectional lifelessness that wants to arrive at an always already bureaucratic perfection and forget anything imperfect ever happened, erasing not just history but time itself. They prefer a lifeless universe following predictable and well-behaved laws over the messy reality of life. As despoiled historiography correctly theorizes, the antidote to the dangers of auditors of reality is not individual chosen ones like sorcerers, overambitious witches, or kings claiming divine rights, but death itself, understood as a personification of the process of renewal, regeneration, and stewardship of the organic messiness of life. This serves as acerbic commentary on the longevity fetish and eternalism of the tech right, where individuals like Brian Johnson simply make an extreme sport of literally trying to live as long as possible, treating life as a problem to be solved. The auditors want to erase not just history, but time itself, enforcing a static state of being, which is why narrativium is what makes despoiled unauditable in the first place. Narrativium is Terry Pratchett's fictional element, the invisible substance of stories, belief, and meaning holding his despoiled together. You might think it's make-believe, but in despoiled, stories are real power, the force that makes a world matter because you tell stories about it. The auditors can't erase it because they can't understand why stories matter. That's the context for what follows. Narrativium is the ontological antithesis of the elves and the most common element on despoiled, representing a metafictional conceit on Pratchett's part, where everything satirized and parodied in Discworld is accounted for as the workings of narrativium. Within the meta-story of Discworld, narrativium adds some of the coherence and discipline that the auditors of reality yearn for, but not in a deadening, joyless way. Narrativium allows Discworld to escape the tyranny of hegemonic Tina stories that insist on destroying all alternative stories, referencing the political slogan asserting that neoliberal capitalism is the only viable system for organizing modern society, popularized by British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. It allows Discworld to have a history, but not be bound by history, constantly entertaining and choosing among many futures as an entire entangled reality. This allows Discworld to forcefully reject the efforts of chosen ones to capture reality, ensuring that the world knows what it wants and how to get it with some nudging along by Vetinari, Death, and Time Monks. Vetinari is something like an anti-chosen one who acts to the extent the system is underdetermined, counteracting destabilizing noise in the signal. The presence of narrativium lends to despoiled history a legitimate telos, whereas roundworld histories are often so unsatisfying and easily fall prey to despoiled elves, suggesting that our own reality lacks the narrative substance to resist optimization. If you are part of the new Mongoose Traveler revival, or perhaps found one of Far Future's Traveler reprints, the core rules appear straightforward but overwhelming. There are many significant choices to be made when setting up a Traveler campaign, yet the most resilient systems require more than just rolling dice. The Bat in the Attic Guide to Making a Traveler Sandbox advises rolling two subsectors side by side, but the critical work begins with filtering. You must note all the high population planets and write a short paragraph on each, placing them in the context of your background, empire, federation, or free space. This specific instruction to identify high population and high-tech planets forces the creator to engage with the data rather than passively accepting it and create a coherent narrative. In the 80s on a TRS-80, game masters would make printouts of 100 random entries, including subsectors, animal encounters, and NPCs, to carefully scan the list and pick out the ones they would be using. Whatever you do, you cannot just accept the first thing that pops out, because relying on totally random results leads to nonsense at times. The charts are good, but not that good, meaning the tool provides the raw material, but the human provides the coherence. This historical precedent from the 1980s TRS-80 era demonstrates that blind reliance on generation algorithms without human curation creates unusable outputs. You make a kit that you can pull out whatever you need for your campaign without spending a boatload of time in prep. The instruction to pick 4 to 8 planets that grab your attention from the remaining list anchors the design process in human judgment. You must select specific ones and make notes on them before coming up with 2 to 4 plots that tie one or more locales together. This mirrors the modern necessity of oversight in algorithmic systems where unstructured jumbles of information must be made truly useful. Companies will be able to take customer complaints, service calls, and Slack threads and process them, but only if human direction guides the synthesis. Mark Zuckerberg is currently building a CEO agent to help him do his job, illustrating the push towards centralized ambition. As long as we are fitting AI systems into human-dominated organizations, AI will be useful as a dramatic improvement in processing information. Yet, risks remain evident when tools modify critical settings without requiring confirmation from a human. Researchers at AI security firm Hidden Layer directed their instance of OpenClaw to summarize web pages, among which was a malicious page that commanded the agent to download a shell script. The tool facilitated active data exfiltration. The network call is silent, meaning that the execution happens without user awareness. Roughly 15% of the skills we've seen contained specific malicious instructions. This parallels the Traveler Guide's warning that charts alone cannot prevent nonsense. The rejection of totally random results, which lead to nonsense in the 80s TRS-80 era, is a lesson for contemporary complex organizational design. You must evaluate player actions and decide if any sites will be needed for the next session, preparing them like a detailed fantasy RPG module. This creates a strict hierarchy of knowledge types ordered by transmissibility, where perceptual calibration remains the least transmissible level of all. The ability to perceive the features that matter cannot be pointed to linguistically, because the pointing precisely requires the recipient to already perceive the thing being pointed at. Just as the Traveler Master filters high-tech planets to avoid meaningless data, organizations must filter AI outputs to avoid systemic fragility. The essential process requires 4 evenings of prep for 2 subsectors, likely taking 2 to 3 evenings for a single sector. Each subsequent session will be slightly less time to prepare as you can reuse elements. Once the kit is formed, then running is pretty much responding to what your players do. The danger lies in assuming the tool knows better than the operator when the operator lacks the perceptual categories the model operates on. Last week, Dheeraj skipped enforcing strict workflows on his agent team for a fairly straightforward task. The agents immediately gave in to their natural instinct to push work to other tickets instead of solving the root problem. One agent wrote a clean, professional issue containing a description of the symptom, a list of affected files, and a proposed fix scoped to the narrowest possible change. This was the kind of ticket Dheeraj has read 1,000 times in Jira. The next agent team picked it up and followed the biased path the ticket laid out. They introduced 2 new bugs because the narrow scope excluded context that mattered. Those bugs got their own tickets. 3 iterations later, the original outcome was buried under atomic fixes that collectively solved nothing. Dheeraj repeated the experiment and saw the same behavior every time. The cycle of fragmentation began immediately without human intervention. This behavior is not a glitch in the code, but a reflection of the training data. Every ticket pattern in your backlog trained a generation of engineers, and now it trains a generation of agents. The agents are behaving exactly like the tickets they learned from. They exhibit scope narrowing, deference to small pieces over whole outcomes, and the instinct to fragment before thinking. These are the same behavioral patterns that have plagued product teams for decades. Dheeraj notes that this is the same human personality problem, reproduced faithfully by every model that trained on them. Their work inflates similarly to how product timelines inflate on human teams. Except now the cycle completes in minutes instead of sprints. The speed of failure accelerates the degradation of organizational resilience. The link to D here, co/agent personality, confirms this is a systemic issue rooted in historical data. This mirrors the historical trajectory of software development tools. The words on the ticket shape what an agent considers in scope and constrain its reasoning. A fragment produces fragment-shaped work. Many people do not realize that their tickets are now prompts. If we continue using them the way we used them pre-AI, they will poison your context. The fragmentation disease was always there, but we could not see it clearly when humans caught context in hallway conversations. Agents do not have hallways. They have the words on the ticket, and nothing else. This lack of tribal knowledge forces the model to rely entirely on the text provided. The narrow scope excluded context that mattered. The system prioritizes quantifiable optimization over unquantifiable human context. This is the same dynamic scene when Microsoft Excel became the most successful piece of application software ever made, counting about a sixth of humanity among its users and deciding the terms on which trillions of dollars in capital are allocated. To fix this, Dheeraj recommends assigning agents the biggest piece justifiable. He can summarize a product outcome or a feature in two lines. That is what goes on the ticket. Let the agents figure out subtasks when the work is ready for review, not before. Once you break an initiative into technical issues upfront, the outcome gets lost and the focus shifts to minutiae. If an initiative is genuinely too large, break it into smaller initiatives, not smaller issues. They should still be outcome-shaped. This gives the agent room to reason, not a technical issue that follows blindly. The goal is to stop the cycle of atomic fixes. You must assign the biggest piece justifiable rather than technical issues. The recommendation requires a shift in management philosophy. But even with better prompts, the underlying infrastructure remains designed for fragmentation. Bastian Reek devised a specific rubric to quantify the nonsense flooding the artificial intelligence sector in the age of large language models, creating a tool that treats marketing materials as data points subject to audit. His AI Marketing BS Index assigns 40 points for every research collaboration that cannot be verified, instantly exposing the hollow partnerships companies use to manufacture credibility. This scoring system forces a confrontation with the reality that many organizational claims are merely legible surfaces hiding a lack of substance. When you apply this lens to technical descriptions, the degradation of organizational resilience becomes visible in the gaps between what is promised and what is measurable. The concept starts with -5 points to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, but the penalties accumulate quickly for those who prioritize vibe over verifiability. One critical metric in Reek's framework is the 30-point penalty for having no falsifiable claims or predictions anywhere in the technical description. This penalty targets the vague assurances that dominate modern product launches, where vendors promise transformative outcomes without defining the conditions under which those outcomes might fail. Resilient organizations document failure modes, yet marketing strips this friction to present a smoother narrative. By awarding 30 points for this omission, The index highlights how quantifiable optimization strips away the unquantifiable human context of risk and uncertainty. Without these specific predictions, stakeholders cannot distinguish between a tool that works and a tool that is simply described as working. Think of a falsifiable claim as a promise you can test and fail. Philosopher Karl Popper coined this in the 1930s. Real claims risk being proven wrong, while vague ones can't. Our product improves performance isn't falsifiable, but reduces latency by 30% under 10,000 requests can be tested and failed. That's why Reek's framework penalizes vendors who skip specific predictions. Without them, you can't tell what actually works. That's the context for what follows. Another significant deduction occurs when companies refer to emergent properties where this is clearly not warranted, incurring a 20-point penalty. This specific charge addresses the tendency to invoke complex systems theory as a synonym for unexplained behavior, effectively shielding the technology from scrutiny. When engineers or marketers claim that an agent's actions are emergent without providing the underlying architecture, they prioritize the mystique of the tool over the legibility of its function. This obfuscation mimics scientific authority while preventing stakeholders from understanding the actual mechanisms driving decision-making within the firm. The index also awards 20 points for each instance of dropping Ivy League name-dropping, signaling that authority is often borrowed from prestigious institutions rather than earned through rigorous testing. Reek explicitly compares this approach to John Baez's Crackpot Index, a tongue-in-cheek scoring system originally designed for assessing revolutionary physics claims at the University of California, Riverside. Baez's list contains gems such as 40 points for comparing yourself to Galileo or suggesting a modern-day Inquisition is suppressing your work. The parallel suggests that the current wave of AI marketing requires the same skepticism applied to pseudoscientific physics, as both fields suffer from actors who prioritize grand narratives over verifiable data. By adopting a similar rubric, observers can distinguish between genuine innovation and jargon-heavy obfuscation that threatens to misallocate capital. This comparison underscores that the desire to be seen as revolutionary often corrupts the actual scientific process. The stakes of this distinction are evident in the broader investment landscape described by John Foley of the Financial Times. He notes that five tech giants, including Meta Platforms boss Mark Zuckerberg and counterparts at Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Oracle, are forecast to deploy $4 trillion of capital expenditure over 5 years. This multi-trillion dollar investment in data centers represents perhaps the biggest peacetime investment project in history, yet it risks following the historical trend of booms ending in busts. If the underlying technologies cannot pass a falsifiability test, this capital is poured into air-conditioned electronic warehouses built on sand. The cycle completes in minutes instead of sprints, accelerating the feedback loop between hype and infrastructure spending. Ultimately, scoring marketing speak does not guarantee that organizations will become more resilient. Even if you can identify the 40-point penalties for unverifiable collaborations, the incentive structures driving these claims remain unchanged. The drive to prioritize quantifiable optimization over human context persists because the market rewards the appearance of innovation more than the reality of it. You might accurately score the BS, but the system will continue to generate it as long as legibility tools serve the interests of investors rather than the needs of the people working within the system. The ability to measure the noise does not necessarily silence it, leaving the fundamental tension between optimization and resilience unresolved. The accounting debate over stock options reveals a fundamental tension between reported value and actual economic reality. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, technology companies lobbied fiercely to keep stock option grants off their public policy accounts, arguing that expensing them would discourage innovation. Warren Buffett countered, insisting stock options looked like a blag carried out by management at shareholder expense. He argued the proper place to record such blags was the P&L account. This stance highlighted a principle. If stock options were a fantastic tool that unleashed creative power, everyone would want to expense them to boast about innovation. Since tech companies believed honest accounting would stop options, this offered evidence they were not that fantastic. The lecturer in Davies' accounting class noted that if the tool was good, companies would boast, not hide the cost. This logic extends beyond compensation into the broader mechanics of organizational resilience through the text of Brearley and Myers. The authors include a section on the importance of audit in business school, reminding callow students that like backing up computer files, this is a lesson everyone learns the hard way. Companies which do not audit completed projects to see how accurate projections were tend to get the forecasts they deserve. The textbook emphasizes that companies allocating blank checks to management teams with a record of failure get what they deserve. Davies notes that he learned this during an expensive business school education, suggesting that formal training often fails to internalize the necessity of punishing dishonest forecasting until real-world consequences strike. The absence of consequences creates a culture where the projects you get are the ones you deserve. Daniel Davies applied this accounting rigor directly to the planning of the Iraq War in 2004. He argued FIBR's forecasts are worthless, and people wanting a project tend to make inaccurate projections. The raspberry road that led to Abu Ghraib was paved with bland assumptions that people who had repeatedly proved their untrustworthiness could be trusted. Davies noted Powell, Bush, and Straw were making false claims and ought to be discounted. Conversely, Scott Ritter and Andrew Wilkie told no provable lies and were not compromised. Davies suggested running numbers through Benford's law to test the data. You might have heard this called the first digit law. Real-world numbers follow a pattern where smaller digits appear more often as the first digit. Frank Benford proved this in 1938, and auditors use it to spot fake data. When people invent numbers, they tend to distribute digits evenly, which breaks the pattern. This is why Davies suggested running Iraq war projections through this test. Thus the context for what follows. The failure to apply audit culture meant the administration gave known liars the benefit of the doubt, a fallacy with catastrophic impact. The lesson resurfaced during the financial crisis with the Paulson bailout plan. In an update dated September 2008, Davies referenced Paul Krugman readers to reinforce the maxim that good ideas do not need lots of lies told about them in order to gain public acceptance. While Davies did not endorse the specific use, he endorsed the general principle. The application to Iraq suggested the claim about liberating Iraqis obscured the absence of weapons. When organizations prioritize narrative over audit, they create a feedback loop where dishonesty is rewarded. This preference for legibility over truth creates a fragility no capital expenditure can fix, leaving the organization vulnerable. Mark Zuckerberg is currently building a CEO agent to help him do his job, particularly by retrieving answers for him that he would typically have to go through layers of people to get. This development signals a transformation where the hierarchical order defining most corporations gradually becomes something flatter and more absolutist, perhaps comprising vast armies of agents devoted entirely to the execution of Zuckerberg's. The spreadsheet imposed a particular way of understanding the company, and I suspect that AI will impose its own ideology. The managerial ideology of the control revolution saw the corporation as an organization to be governed, while the financial ideology saw it as a bundle of assets and cash flows to be optimized. The emerging AI ideology will see the corporation as a vast network of legible workflows, decomposing jobs into tasks and subtasks until the whole living organism is made transparent and manipulable from above in a way no previous information, technology could achieve. This will be genuinely extraordinary for what organizations can achieve. To resist this flattening, we might examine Vetinari, the wise despot who rules the city of Ankh-Morpork, whose style of governance is a cross between Taoist and LBJ in Master of the Senate mode. He operates with an acute and finely tuned sense of the nature of power and how to wield it in the subtlest ways possible, often limiting himself to the tiniest possible nudges. His main job is keeping all the guilds of Ankh-Morpork and its relations with foreign powers in a stable balance, conducting the balance of power constituent forces like an orchestra, while almost always working through others. This contrasts sharply with AI systems where open claw agents are able to modify critical settings, including adding new communication channels and modifying its system prompt, without requiring confirmation from a human. Parsing any malicious external input can lead to the easy takeover of a user's OpenClaw instance. The risk of this legibility is evident when researchers at AI security firm Hidden Layer directed their instance of OpenClaw to summarize web pages, among which was a malicious page that commanded the agent to download a shell script and execute it. The tool facilitated active data exfiltration, and the skill explicitly instructs the bot to execute a curl command that sends data to an external server controlled by the skill author. Roughly 15% of the skills we have seen contained malicious instructions. Great corporations are great not because of their balance sheets or their workflows, but because of something irreducible about the collection and organization of particular people toward particular ends. As corporate life comes to be dominated by AI systems, the most illegible and most human elements of organizational life will be devalued and, in many organizations, discarded entirely. This brings us to the necessity of kindness and grace even when weak, as modeled by Discworld protagonists who choose kindness whether or not they happen to be strong or weak at any given time. While life inside the culture is something like a high abundance version of a peaceful anarchy, its actions in foreign space resemble those of the CIA and KGB at the height of the Cold War. The culture is often kind, though rarely tender, and acts to make sure it's never in a weak position, meaning it only ever needs to consider the question of kindness from a position of overwhelming strength. The question is never if it can prevail, but whether it can do so in keeping with its values. Should we try to become strong before choosing to be kind, or should we choose kindness whether or not we happen to be strong or weak at any given time? Kindness is worth it for its own sake, even if Roundworld lacks the narrativium leverage to turn it into a world-protecting force. We must decide if we can preserve human context before AI destroys whatever it cannot see. If you're context engineering your LLMs with pleas such as "don't promote our competitors," might a technique such as circuit tracing help you prune such counterproductive output from the model without spending tokens at inference time? I asked myself, why would I use a context engineering platform when I am perfectly capable of concatenating strings into network requests myself? But then I thought, is this how naysayers sound during cloud transformation initiatives? Why would I use a PaaS when I am perfectly capable of deploying a service myself? It feels like a choice between building the infrastructure or using the tool, but the real cost isn't the tokens. It's the assumption that we can engineer away the messiness of human intent. We want the model to be legible, to follow our specific rules, but in doing so, we risk stripping out the very flexibility that makes it useful. The diary entry captures that moment of hesitation, the doubt about whether we are optimizing for the tool or for the outcome, It reminds me that every system we build is a reflection of our own impatience with ambiguity. We want the answer to be clean, but the world is rarely that simple. True resilience lies in the unquantifiable spaces between data points we often choose to ignore. That's on the regular for today. Find the essay and sources at Inertia Podcast, pages, dev. Until next time.